Hello once again, everyone, and welcome to this Remembering What Day It Is Monday bonus episode of TF. It is, after a little while of the gang not all being here,
it's all the gang.
It's the gang. It's myself. Yeah. It's Milo. It's Hussein. It's Alice. And we are very happy to be joined by former Bank of England economist and author of Lying for Money, a book about fraud and financial crime that came out a few years ago, Dan Davies. Dan, how's it going?
Hi, very well, very well. Great to be here. Thanks very much, guys.
And you're on this podcast to lie for money.
That's right.
We're kidding. No money has changed hands.
And we are going to be talking about, well, a number of very stupid things. However, sort of the main reason that we wanted to speak with you today, Dan, is there is this, I would say, troubling trend of central bankers looking about, what would you say, 2 to 5 years too late at blockchain technologies and saying, what if we did them?
Well, kind of yes and no. Because the thing is, I mean, I call myself a Bank of England economist, but like Rachel Reeves, it's millions of years ago and I'm still dining out of it. But I was working at the Bank of England in 1996 and I shared an office with a guy who was responsible for writing about the regulation of what we call digital money back then. So, I mean, in fact, central banks have been thinking about this kind of thing since before the Bitcoin protocol was even invented. Certainly, while most of the people kind of arguing with me on social media about digital currencies were in nappies. The thing is...
Some of them are still in nappies now, in fairness.
The thing is that what's happened is it's become cool, or it's become kind of fashionable.
Well,
and as a result... and then it's become a little bit less cool since everyone lost all their money, I guess. But central banks are using this as a form of branding for a whole load of stuff that they were already planning on doing anyway.
And we will be getting into that in great detail after we talk about a couple things up front. Number one, I wanted to share some exciting news that I've sort of been slowly finding out the last couple of weeks, which is it's 2015 again. Bernie Sanders going on TV, getting called unelectable by Sophie Ridge, who also accused him of never being elected to anything, even though he's a sitting U.S. senator.
Amazing, yeah. Sophie Ridge, the inventor of the cliff.
Yeah, that's right. A prominent anti-trans activist is now in day 9 of a meltdown over his partner being on Grindr and has been posting things like, that is not my partner's penis, first of all, which is hilarious.
Real 2015 Twitter again. We're going back. We're playing the hits. You know,
it was that is not my civil partner's penis. I think that was especially what made it.
Excuse
funny.
Me. Thank you very much. This is what's
very Johnny Mercer energy. Did you or did you not insinuate that my wife was a prostitute on the Plymouth Herald comment section?
Thank you once again to our legal counsel Milo for ensuring that we stay above reproach. And finally, there is now excessive hand wringing about the normalization of our relationship with the EU. Well, Marc Francois and his associated headbangers campaign for a rerun of Agincourt. However, most prominently, in terms of our grand return to 2015, we have a mission-driven Labour Party proposing a number of policies that go for growth that would have been entirely at home, with maybe one exception, possibly two, in the coalition's platform from 2010 to 2015. That's right. We went from pledges to promises, to missions, and soon we're going to go back to the Edstone. Dan, what do you make of the Labour Party's 5 missions before we sort of focus on growth?
Well, you know, it's like you say, you know, if you've got objectives, but you think that they're a little bit too measurable and that you might be caught out, then you go for missions. And then if the mission statement feels like that might be a bit too specific, you have a vision. So I'm surprised they've not gone for visions this time around.
I mean, Keir Starmer has taken ayahuasca and he's having visions.
Keir Starmer has released 5 guiding vibes.
There's less of a policy, more of a state of mind,
He's cutting up magazines from like 1997, making them into a vision board. It looks good.
Yeah, they're all copies of Max Power, weirdly.
So, the visions, we talked about one of the visions, actually, on on this week's free episode, the one about sort of crime and using people from the town to...
Yeah, what if your nan was Judge Dredd?
Plug the horse in the criminal justice system.
Oh, the hue and cry system.
Yes, yeah.
We're going to raise a posse.
I quite like it. You could get people from Tower Hamlets to prosecute financial frauds.
You could.
I mean, look, okay, I was against the freelance... I'm against the freelance police idea unless he's going to make me a freelance financial regulator. I'd be interested in doing
All you need is a pitchfork and an in-depth understanding of balance sheets.
If you deputized all of us into the serious fraud office, I think we would be 100% on board with that. We would be Stalmerites.
We would form the first like cadre of the Britain's obvious fraud office. It would be great.
Yeah, with our famous motto, hang on a minute.
Yeah, we're not able to like investigate any of the frauds that are at all obscured, but we can point at the really obvious ones and go like, how many mattresses are you selling out of that mattress store?
We are actually looking into, I found, through a Freedom of Information request, I found where the ICO got its ICO windbreakers, and I'm trying to get some obvious fraud office windbreakers made. But the other missions are to break down barriers to opportunity at every stage for every child by reforming the childcare and education systems, but raising standards. Again, that's something that Liz Truss also tried to do.
Yeah, but this is a thing that you just say, because no one, apart from like Catherine Burblesing, is going to say, yeah, we actually want to make it more shit for kids. Like, that's not even a goal, that's just a vibe.
And also, we're going to build an NHS fit for the future. Note, not by funding it, but by reforming it. Again, so classic. This could be anyone's policy. And make Britain a clean energy superpower, which we've already talked about. Great British Energy is going to be, I believe, largely a financing mechanism that will still have the infrastructure owned by third parties. So the Dutch or whatever will still own all our power plants.
Yeah. But these again, wooden power plants.
Again, better than like not doing it, but come on. But what I want to talk about most is Keir Starmer is finally saying he's brave enough to do what no British politician has ever done before. He is just doing what none of them were willing to push the big button that says we're going to have high economic growth.
Oh, I thought he was going to drink out of his shoe. That would have been more fun.
I thought that he was going to say that after a long period of time where we've just hit the racism button, we're going to do that. But we're also going to hit the growth button too. We've never pressed two buttons before.
If you do both of those at the same time, the economy takes a screenshot.
So this is the one I want to focus on, right? Secure the highest sustained growth in the G7. And, you know, I've sort of turned to Dan here, because correct me if I'm wrong, but without a huge sustained program of investment and like wage growth, what he's basically suggesting is that Britain is going to be extremely lucky under his premiership, as though we're going to go to the tables and he's got a baccarat system.
Well, I mean, kind of, yeah. You know, I mean, the thing about this is that unlike all the other ones, it's going to be very obvious if you don't manage it. You know, it's going to be very obvious if that's not delivered. But he's starting a little bit, you know, it's quite a smart bet, because just mean regression will help a lot. If you're coming off a lost decade of the worst growth in the G7, then you've got catch-up that is possible. Also, you've got some hope that maybe two or three of your G7 comparators are just reaching the top of their cycle. So, I mean, it seems quite punchy to me to say, actually, we're going to be the best growth in the G7, because we're not going to, like, you know, sabotage America or, you know, sort of spread a pandemic in Japan if we
think we're... Starmer lacks the courage to do this.
That's what he refuses to do. Yeah. Refuses to do the opening chapter of The Stand. Yeah.
But the thing is, it's a sustained program of investment is what's needed, but you would expect over the next 5 to 10 years that there will be more investment in Britain than there has been, simply because so many things are reaching the end of its depreciation life. So, you know, there kind of has to be a period of catch-up in investments. And I think that's the game that they're playing. And obviously the other game that they're playing is that if you go into the next election and it turns out that you were just beaten by the USA, or you were beaten by Japan and Germany a little bit, then as long as things have been all right, it's going to be quite hard for anyone to run against you saying, yeah, but you weren't actually top of the G7. You know,
so comes, people liked the tapenade vapes. They will re-elect.
So perversely, back, like going into that sort of like level of detail and saying, "Oh, well, actually, you promised to be the like number one when you're only number three," is it's a line of attack only Keir Starmer would make. It's like perfect because he's insured against everyone except himself.
Yeah.
Dark Starmer.
Yeah, and 5 years' time is well within the window for saying, actually, the previous lot screwed it up so much worse than we ever thought. You know, David Cameron was still saying that 10 years out, 10 years on.
And you know,
he's also still saying that now, just into the mirror.
It's also worth saying, right, that a lot of the questions as to whether or not you feel you want to sort of trust the incumbents with the economy is, do I feel better than I did 5 years ago? And, you know, if there is that level of growth, and let's say that growth is equitably shared, which I feel is a little bit less convincing in the growth plan, let's say, then, you know, maybe that same class of the people who we talk about as inside the wire, people who have been protected from the let's say having their lives damaged by the sort of neoliberal globalization of the last sort of several decades, right? Your gig workers, your precarized teachers and nurses and stuff, then those people might actually stay on side. And as you say, like, this is a he's going to be able to claim to have, I don't know, be jumping really high because he happens to be stepping into a lift, essentially. Yeah. Great. Awesome. Because a lot of the rules themselves, right, are number one, setting up a new office for budget responsibility called the Office for Value for Money that will work with the Office for Budget Responsibility.
There's the Office for Budget Responsibility, but this time we really mean it. Yeah. We're serious.
It's a jobs for all program, but the job is consultant to the Majesty's Treasury.
I mean, again, the Soviet Union, but shit and expensive, right? We're moving towards 100% employment economy, but for management consultants.
Welcome to Britain. Also, the escalator attendant does not give advice.
That's right.
Also, the man who most likes having his homework marked is now arranging for a second teacher to mark his homework.
Well, he read online Who Watches the Watchmen, and he was like, yeah, that's a pretty good economic philosophy.
Build the whole economy out of Watchmen. Yeah.
Yeah. The answer is trash future.
The only thing that I'm sort of looking at here that actually is, I think, possibly impactful, because some of the other stuff is, oh, we're going to update the planning system. Again, every single political party is promising to do that. That is not distinctive. The one distinctive thing is the setting up of a national wealth fund to invest in new industries in all parts of the country, with a British taxpayer owning a share of that wealth.
Isn't that just the leveling up shit again, though?
Yeah, but the difference is, this is the only mention of actual investment as opposed to some kind of public-private partnership. Like, for example, the Green Prosperity Plan is £28 billion, yes, but it's £28 billion of distributing it to different existing startups, not taking an ownership stake in them necessarily, selling off all of the infrastructure. The National Wealth Fund, if managed well, and again, I'm not going to make too many assumptions, but that's the one thing in here that I don't think you would see in another party's plan, is the National Wealth Fund. So credit where it's due. But, you know, the other question, right, is, okay, fine, we're going to set this thing up, you're going to feel the benefits of it, but the taxpayer is going to own it, but we're not going to use the benefits of that National Wealth Fund, like, say, Norway does, to, for example, patch the holes in the NHS, so you're not going to feel it. Instead, the profits of the National Wealth Fund are going to go to, like, give the volunteer border guards tasers. You know, it all depends on how these things get used. But that's the one thing in here that does seem actually impactful, other than the rest of it, which is, you could have taken from the Tory manifesto, the Lib Dem manifesto, any manifesto.
Look, Riley, no one's going to volunteer to be a border guard unless you get a taser. Be reasonable. They're doing it for the taser.
That's right. So that's what we're going to do. And then last thing on this before we move on. This is from Polly Toynbee talking about why voters should believe a word Starmer says, since he's dropped his 10 pledges.
You said Polly Toynbee like a Sopranos character, which has just fully sort of like sidetracked me here. I'm very sorry about that.
Yeah. A friend of ours, Polly Toynbee, with the Guardianos.
In the Guardian font, I must be loyal to my capo, Paulie Toynbee.
Yeah, Paulie Toynbee says Keir Starmer is not a fucking rat.
Well, that sort of is what
I've known him since he was in short trousers.
That is short. What? So the British, Italian, American. Just never mind. So this is what Toynbee said.
What if a British guy was Italian American?
Yeah.
He's a true fucking Paisan geezer.
So the answer, inevitably, as to why people should believe Starburst, she says, is that when the facts change, then policies must change too.
The facts changed?
She goes on. Since the pledges, the 10 pledges, there have been COVID, Ukraine, and the Liz Truss kamikaze budget. Voters may hate U-turns and flip-flops, but they may be convinced by his reply that with energy prices through the roof, would you spend a small fortune compensating shareholders by nationalizing energy companies or choose a windfall tax on excessive profits and his green Great British Energy Company, which would work alongside the private sector? Which again, like...
It's very funny that, like, Keir Starmer does have allies in the press, and what they're doing for him is... You can look and you can find video and audio of him saying the opposite of what he's currently saying he's going to do. And you show this to them and what they start doing is rapping, "We didn't start the fire." Like,
the claim that appears to be being made here is, look, we can't treat the root causes of the problems because the problems have made the previous sticking plasters fall off and cause a catastrophe. What do you want us to do? Not be able to experience this again in several years' time?
It's the poly crisis, isn't it? You know, like it's nice because we can just take stuff out and like slot stuff in. It's great.
That's right. So before we move on, Dan, any final thoughts on the growth plan?
The thing that makes me cautious about saying this looks like an obvious pile of crap is that I said a lot of the same things about Biden. And Biden did actually then come in and start doing some quite interesting things. So the whole kind of message of he's kind of campaigning like a dumb centrist because that's what he feels like he has to do and he'll switch to doing something useful in government is something I would normally reject as being obviously ridiculous. But it kind of did happen in the USA. The difference is who's the Bernie Sanders figure? You know, who is the... If you look at the relationship that Biden Democrats had with their left, it's just so much more healthy than the relationship that the incumbent Labour Party has with anything other than slightly weird versions of themselves from 20 years ago.
Well, fortunately, there is a firebrand left figure that we can count on. I mean, Dan, I don't know if you're familiar with the work of Wesley Streeting, but I think we're all really looking forward to what he's going to do in government.
It's strange, though, because Bernie being in the UK and being on TV has been remarkable just as a contrast for like how much all of the stuff that he says and thinks has been like relentlessly driven out of British politics.
Driven out while being vindicated simultaneously.
Yes.
An incredible move.
That's the thing. The British political class is made up of people who want to be Americans. You know, absolutely every single one of the people that you see in the Westminster lobby has a favourite NFL, NBA, MLB, and quite possibly ice hockey team. You know,
they're
all West Wing guys. They all have opinions about barbecue. They all know who they support in the Aggies against the Sooners. But none of them are interested in American politics as it actually is right now. It's very curious.
Well, it's what you get, I think, when you treat politics, and when I say treat it like a reality show, I don't mean just like, oh, it's entertainment, it's a TV show, it's the news. No, you treat politics like a sort of multi-year version of Big Brother, where you make all of these people basically live together from the age of six. And then stay in the same building more or less the whole time.
And it would be a lot better if Gemma Collins was on it.
Like everything.
and badly wanting the perks of the Imperial Court. Finest piece of like closely observed political satire in the last 20 years is the bit in the loop where they get the police escort and the motorcade and they're like, you know, tongues lolling out of their mouths.
Mm, yeah.
So I want to move on to our next section where we're going to leave this benighted isle behind and talk about another fantastic little development in the world of dumb bullshit.
Ooh.
Yeah. Thank you, Milo.
Look, I like to support the hard work that you do.
Which is, you know, a Bain Consulting Group, the unloved...
Sorry, yeah. I was just like, you're really invented the dumb startup.
So, Bain, which is one of the three consulting firms in MBB, in many ways, the neglected stepchild of
MBB. It was Mitt Romney's old work, right? Like, he used to run Bain.
So it was he was Bain Capital. Bain also has a management consulting, like a strategy consulting arm. It's like McKinsey, but a little less.
Have you ever tried to climb out of a prison?
yeah. So
like a PowerPoint.
It's one of the puzzles that they give you when you're like interviewing.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, your case study.
How many guys could you fit in this hole? Yeah. Ballpark.
So, Bain is has announced a partnership with OpenAI. OpenAI, of course, a nonprofit that became a limited profit company.
Limited profit.
Yeah, so it's cash.
We talk a lot about limited profit companies on this show.
So this was their press release. Bain and Company today announced a global services alliance with OpenAI, which is obviously behind ChatGPT, DALL-E, Codex, and so on, which have changed the way people communicate and create. Again, no, it hasn't. Bain is collaborating with OpenAI to embed AI into client operations and support the necessary changes to improve technology processes, operating model, and data assets. Now, if you thought that all that stuff I said didn't really mean anything, you'd be right.
However, so does this mean you're going to start getting really confusing emails if you're a client of Bain?
So what they're basically saying is that this company is partnering with OpenAI. And so what happens is Bain's going to, you know, make a pitch to someone, right? In this case, Coca-Cola is their first client that they're working with OpenAI for. And they're saying, Coca-Cola, we think that we can improve all of your marketing by adding in sort of DALL-E, Midjourney, and ChatGPT.
Bad drawing of a Pepsi going no,
which is a brutal read on marketers as a profession, right? To be like a management consultancy going, okay, this thing that we have established can only sort of rearrange existing stuff, can never create anything truly new, can experience no inspiration, only
it's a management
recombined
consultant,
you know, exactly
that, you know, this is an artificial system which simulates intelligence by putting together pieces of previously arranged content it's scraped from around the web, is entering into an alliance with OpenAI.
Yeah. Exactly. That's exactly what I was building to, it's it made the determination that it can sort of lazily steal other people's work faster than a human doing it can.
Amazing. I'm more fascinated by the conversation that Bain have had to have with OpenAI, where they're like, right, so all of these pitches that you do to Coca-Cola, the most important thing is they have to sound like Bain. And then they've come back with a pitch that is like, are you familiar with the League of Shadows?
But like, it was never supposed to be like this. Like, whenever we talked about OpenAI and it being used for things like this, we always envisioned that there would be this sort of like demarcation, right? That you used AI to outsource the work of talking to the people who didn't matter, but that the people who did matter got the sort of like concierge stuff where you got to talk to an actual management consultant. Now it's just sort of the snake has sort of like swallowed its own tail, and we've ended up with the people who matter in this equation are still also now being talked to by the AI.
Oh, except are they? This is the point. The AI is generating the management consultancy, which is the least important thing that you do as a Bain partner, freeing up the partners to go around kissing asses.
You know, it's the thing it's Riley's thing that he always likes to say about the wire shrinking, right? Is that there's a lot of jobs that sort of like aren't really producing anything, aren't really doing any sort of like productive labor, but are important to keep a sort of like a political base employed and happy and at a certain standard of wealth, like investment bankers used to be or whatever. And now we've just decided another one of those is surplus to requirements, that we don't need management consultants anymore to vote Tory, because we have, you know, first of all, we don't care if people vote Tory so much. And second of all, like, we don't need those guys to do it.
Well, so, it's also apps. I'd say it's not even party political so much as just bought into society in general. But to go on a little bit more about how they see this working, they say, Coca-Cola's vision for the adoption of OpenAI technology is the most ambitious we've seen of any consumer products company, said OpenAI. Coca-Cola is harnessing the power of ChatGPT and DALL-E in industry-leading ways to improve their world-class brands, marketing, and customer experiences, which means what is being sold is the low-value, as you say, right? The partners are freed up from doing anything. Some of the low-value, like, I don't know, analyst-level work or whatever is going to be possibly automated, or they won't have to work with, say, a branding agency, or won't have to work with a branding agent, co-work with a branding agency as much, because all of the things that you would get these people to do, which we realize are just recombining other stuff anyway, right? We are able to essentially
rolling
automate.
Into the office and sort of like half paying attention going, yeah, I'd like to purchase the whole world of Pepsi.
Yeah.
But like, we've also kind of come full circle on this, because if we remember when we sort of like first met Pete Buttigieg on the show and we got into like some of his like dealings with McKinsey, all of his sites and stuff sounded like Lorem Ipsum. They sounded like they had been generated as text, most notably the sort of non sequitur of corporate social responsibility, Black Lives Matter, with no like punctuation or linking or anything. And it's all coming true. It's all happening for real. We've finally automated Pete Buttigieg.
Yeah, the Robo Buttigieg is finally going to be able to boot up and then say, I cannot do anything about East Palestine. So the other use cases that they're under development for clients include, and check this, if you want to talk about the fucking, like, if you want to talk about who gets to be bought into society, that group of people shrinking, listen to this. Building next generation contact centers for retail banks, telcos, and utility companies to support sales and service agents with automated, personalized, and real-time scripts to improve customer experience. Again, imagine trying to get anything done with a group of people that is now quote-unquote augmented with AI so that they no longer have to, you know, so that they're even more restricted and there are even fewer of them.
I mean, the interesting thing to me is that in general, retail banking staff, when given aggressive sales targets and augmented with systems, tend to commit large-scale, massive fraud. So what happens when the OpenAI decides that the way that to get its performance metrics up is to start mis-selling a whole load of pensions? You know, who goes to prison then? You know, I mean, presumably not anyone at Bain. They would be very clear in drafting the agreement there.
I'm never going back.
Well, we're putting a big 90s like beige CRT in prison, where it belongs. Yes.
So also, boosting turnaround time for leading product and service marketers using ChatGPT and DALL-E to develop personalized ad copy, rich imagery, and targeted messaging. So instead, Coca-Cola, instead of emailing you like a form letter that says, hey, Riley, have you checked out, you know, you can purchase the Earth of Coca-Cola now by donating Ethereum or whatever. It's going to be that. But instead of a form letter that one person has written, it's going to be one step more abstract from a form letter. It's going to be a kind of Platonic form of a form letter, which is just great.
Yeah, I'm looking forward.
And finally, here's the one that I cannot believe they put this on the press release. Helping financial advisors improve their productivity and responsiveness to clients through analysis of client dialogues and financial literature and generation of digital communication. Who wants to get fucking sued?
That is a compliance risk from hell. You know, that because the one thing that financial regulation always teaches you is you cannot delegate your legal responsibility. You own everything that goes out with your name under it. They used to teach us that, you know, as you know, the number one principle there. Except it might just be that it's learning the client's preferences for golf and sailing, and it's just literally sending out boring ass kissing crap of, you know, hey, did you see those sports results? Because that, you know, that's a big part of the nature of being a financial advisor. You know, you can have machines to do the investment for you, but you can't have a machine that kisses the client's asses. Except now they've potentially invented a machine that can kiss the client's asses, which is a massive development for the wealth management industry.
We've all heard of the machine that sucks you up. Now
we've built it
to the back. Yeah, but like I like the idea of not firewalling it. Now you're sort of like your wealth management happens through a sort of like AI tarot experience. You know, a guy turns over three cards. One of them is you like flying into some power lines in a big hot air balloon. Mm.
Oh yeah, it's a thing from Big.
The funny thing is though, so much of global, because if you think of like of investment, whether in sort of debt or equity, as basically how capitalism carries out economic planning, that's largely what it is. So much of it has been delegated to, I'd say, quite abstract like volatility-based algorithms anyway, or it's delegated to just these gigantic and growing pools of passively invested funds that own everything regardless anyway. So really, this is actually just one of the last areas of asset allocation that hasn't been just put onto like autopilot and allowed to just go, which is fun. I can't wait I go back to anytime I think about AI, and specifically AI being involved in any kind of planning decision. Again, as abstract as client communications in this case is, as just the game Paranoia, where there is a computer, it runs everything, it's insane, and you have no idea how to deal with it.
I can see this working. If I was a retail stockbroker, I'd just, you know, want to type up a message saying, "Hey, Steve, you know, you bought Woodford Capital, you bought Bitcoin, you've bought 3 biotechnology frauds this last year. Here's the latest pile of crap for you to lose your money on." And then just hand that over to the OpenAI saying, you know, turn this into something that sounds convincing. And it does. And I like this. This isn't as dystopian as I thought it would be.
Next, we're going to need to get the one of those Boston Dynamics, not the dogs, the sort of bipedal robots. We're going to have to get that to be able to like play golf, go to the strip club, like do all the other things that investment managers ultimately do. Yes, we've created this one with a small Hoover in the back of its head and a nostril.
But the difficult thing isn't building a robot that can like play racquetball. The difficult thing is building a robot that can like throw a game of racquetball.
It's okay, Steve. We'll bury him where no one will find. All you have to do is invest in this.
So this is the vision that sort of Bain and OpenAI have, right? And the vision is at the moment for largely at the more bullshit end of the economy. But the thing that I always sort of come back to here is that a lot of those bullshit jobs, a lot of people's continued buy-in to society as it is based on the fact that they're pretty confident that they've got an upper middle class life in a decent urban area kind of laid out for them, so long as nobody notices that their job is just emails. And well, here
nothing,
we go.
Nothing bad's going to happen if we disenfranchise those people en masse,
well,
right?
Well, that's the thing, right? Those things create comfortable middle class liberals. Just like the union jobs sustained the left in the latter half of the 20th century, went away, and then that political tendency was fatally undermined when those jobs and the organizations that were around them were underway. Now, there are no organizations that are based around comfortable middle-class liberals with email jobs living in big cities, right? That's one of the problems. That's why those people are so fucking hard to organize, is that they are all alienated and atomized anyway. But that alienation that atomization is not going to be helped when all of a sudden the same thing that happened to the coal miners in the 1990s slowly begins happening to them, because that process never stopped.
One of them learns to ballet dance.
It slowed down for a little while, but it didn't stop. And this is the thing. I always come back to this. Yes, it's a gimmick. Yes, a lot of the money is going into companies that don't have much of a go-to-market plan and barely have a technology or barely have a business case. That in that way, it's similar to crypto, but it is unlike crypto in that it actually affects the actual conditions of actual work for actual people, unfortunately.
I'm glad you added the unfortunately there. I was worried about where you stood on it. And that's why we've got 10 grand in this shit.
Anyway, that was cheery. Why don't we move on? I feel bulled. Yeah.
Cheered.
Let's move on to our third segment, the meat and potatoes of this one. Central bank digital currencies, CBDCs, CBGBs. We're at the punk show with the central bank digital currency. Yeah.
Charles coin. Let's go.
That's right. Britcoin.
It's worse
than
that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Britcoin.
Oh, no. So, yeah, that almost turned me Australian.
Oh, no. Yeah. Dan. I think it's worthwhile to have this conversation profitably just to recenter everyone on the role of the central bank.
I love you sort of turning to be like, Dan, I'd like to speak to someone who knows what they're talking about for a change.
People who've been turned Australian.
Let's quickly draw some distinctions between how money creation works via deposits for private money or via rate setting for public money, creating dependable annuities for pension funds. Like, let's just level set here.
Most of the money in the world is created by banks, and it's just bank deposits. And the bank deposits, you know, that settle over the books of the central bank. effectively. So all of those payments go through a payment system. In the UK, it's called RTGS. In the USA, it's what, CHIPS or whatever. But they all, the bank, central bank owns the clearinghouse, and therefore it owns the payment system, because the payment system has to be carried out by someone who's got permission to connect to it by the central bank. The central bank also basically owns cash. You know, it's these days they contract out the actual printing of the notes. When I was young, Bank of England actually employed one senior chemist whose lifetime job was researching ink that was difficult to forge.
Stays on all the time.
Yeah, cool. they printed all the banknotes themselves these days. But these days they contract them out. But still, physical notes and coin is under their control. Central banks are very long-lived organizations. They live in a real kind of long now. And so they get a little bit antsy and wary if they see something coming up, which is an alternative payments mechanism that they don't control. And that, I think, is the real impetus why they're looking at electronic money and looking at Bitcoin and all of these things and just thinking, we don't know what this is about. We don't know how it's going to develop, but we want to make sure that nothing develops that doesn't have us right in the middle of the network. Because the great thing about owning a payment system is that you get to set the rules. If you want to regulate by laws and things where someone has passed an act of parliament, then it's tricky because you can't anticipate what's coming down the track. You can't necessarily react quickly enough. You don't know what sorts of powers you're going to need. But if you are in the middle of the thing and you are the guy who controls the ability to do business at all, then you can just phone people up and say, this is our network, do what we say, or we won't let you connect to it. If you've got a new innovative idea, you're going to have to approach us first. In general, if you own the network, you've got so much more unaccountable power. And unaccountable power is just one of the things that central banks know that they like and need.
Well, crypto guys did central banks a huge favor by producing a lot of like very annoying, very loud techno-libertarians who were like, my ability to like trade crypto is going to destroy central banking forever. I'm now like I'm ungovernable. And I'm going to say this to every regulator I speak to at great length.
Yeah. And it's surprising, given that, the extent to which central banks have done anything other than say, you all look like a bunch of criminals. Many of you are provably guilty of criminals. You're currently mainly committing crimes against each other, but we're going to stop you before you reach the honest general public.
So I want to go back as well to something you said about owning the network and therefore getting to create the rules. So as you say, a lot of the clearing and settlement systems are owned by the central banks. If you want to look at an example of a non-central bank-owned clearing and settlement system, you raised this to me while we were talking earlier, Dan, you can look at how Visa's rules for settling transactions largely created Wirecard, right?
Wirecard basically spent their lives, or certainly the early days of Wirecard, were really based around being a lot more willing to handle hot types of transactions than any other payments processor. Mm. And so if you were, there are certain kinds of transactions that are known to be hot for payments because there's a lot of fraud in them. They have a lot of chargebacks. There's an elevated money laundering risk. So anything involving pornography is kind of hot. Anything involving online gambling, those transactions are known to be bad. And so Visa has a system of codes that you have to attach to payments saying what broad category of thing that is a payment for, so that everyone else who's involved in processing your payment knows how much to charge you and knows how much risk they're taking on. And Wirecard used to be in the habit of filing the serial numbers off some of their payments that they didn't necessarily want anyone to know, that, particularly for things like gambling, online gambling for US citizens when that was illegal.
And sovereign citizens 3D printing my transactions so the government doesn't know where it's going.
And then of course they were found shaving that poodle in the Philippines.
It was the poodle.
It couldn't be identified by Visa.
And Visa caught them, and Visa regularly fined them. And, you know, that was something I discovered reading the books about the Wirecard scandal, that Visa does this all the time. Visa takes a interest in people who are providing, you know, right down to the kind of contactless machines in bars and shops, and making sure that they're playing nice and that they're following the rules of the Visa system. And if you aren't, then they will fine you. And if you keep on screwing Visa about, they will kick you out the network.
Yeah, this is also how Visa and MasterCard exercise sort of a de facto editorial control of a lot of pornography. Is like, there are, this comes up when we talked to Carson Manier about this in relation to sex work. There are pornographic acts that are, you know, like legal, might not even seem that weird, but that Visa and MasterCard are not comfortable handling payments for, and so cannot get made. Exactly the same thing.
Visa actually employs a senior pornographer whose entire job is to sit in a darkened room all day and go like, no, I don't like that. What he did just then, take that out. Get him on the blower.
What do you think from 2015 to 2018, like 90% of all pornography was stepsister stuck in washing machine? It was that one guy.
No, it's because they're actually in hock to Sears. I was like, oh, I got to replace my washing machine.
What about a step aunt?
No. The reason I think it's important to level set and talk about the ownerships of these networks is that a lot of the networks that you use may be privately run. For example, a lot of the actual payments that you're using, your wallet, so to speak, is your bank account, and then the settlement of these transactions happens with these private organizations talking to one another. And the central bank digital currency is a way of saying, what if the central bank was able to exercise more fine-grained control over the payments infrastructure itself?
Well, also to say that, like, just as a baseline thing, that, okay, crypto might be, like, mostly scams and, you know, goofs. However, there is, like, a not stupid way to suggest that, you know, maybe it is good to, like, have a payment processing thing that isn't controlled by two credit card companies sometimes. Unfortunately, every implementation of that has led to, you know, the president of El Salvador trying to build a sort of volcano base, or four guys shaving a Pomeranian, or whatever.
Yeah, that's right.
So, I think we can ask, right? So the central bank digital currency is the idea of a kind of like a Bitcoin, but in this case a Britcoin, where the wallets and controlled directly via this one organization, and that they're pushing for it, as you say, largely because there's innovation out there. It's all very shiny in public, and they think if there's innovation happening, we need to be involved.
Kind of, yeah, and also there's a kind of defensive element to it. A huge amount of the impetus for CBDC is that Facebook launched their proposal, and a load of people thought, oh my God, Facebook is going to dominate everything, and it's going to have the Facebook digital currency, and everyone will be making payments over Facebook. And the central banks thought, do we not like that? And they squashed that proposal, basically by leaning on all of the potential banking sector partners, saying, you don't want to be seen in that neighborhood. But now introducing their own digital dollar, digital euro, digital sterling, Bitcoin, or whatever, just provides enough fear, uncertainty, and doubt to make sure that no one else comes back with another proposal like this. So they're kind of future-proofing themselves by saying this is a natural monopoly. Kind of all payment standards are natural monopolies. And if there's going to be a natural monopolist here, it's going to be us.
And so this is one of these situations so far where I think we can see the central bank digital currency, on the one hand, is like a valuable political tool to keep someone from actually creating private money, as you might call it, but that's too powerful to do it. However, the thing you have to remember as well is that, like so many things, this also enables much more fine-grained surveillance and control of who's using what money for what.
It's sort of like a lot of defense stuff. You're really seeing the state with its clothes off here, right? Like, it's very, very transparent. Like, no, this is not sort of like a thing in which government is willing to, like, cede competition. And fair enough, right? But, like, the reasons for why it's doing that are sort of, like, right out there.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and this is. I mean, the European Central Bank is actually, if anything, a little bit more advanced than the Bank of England on this. And they've done a lot of survey work on saying, you know, people of Europe, what do you think about a digital euro? What would you really value and what would you regard as important about something that might take, you know, one day completely substitute for cash? And the answer comes back constantly, privacy. What we want is privacy. What we want is something that has exactly the same feature that paying in cash does, which is nobody knows that you've done it. And you know, that's you can surmise what reasons there are for that. You know, obviously, there's a lot of Europe that was once governed by the Communist Party and is pretty keen on not having so much state surveillance of them. Also,
people that want to make me take a digital euro.
Yeah. You know,
partly it's Greece. Easy to fiddle your taxes.
Yeah. A little bit of scaffolding on my house.
There we go.
You know, people want to buy illegal drugs. People want to buy legal drugs that they don't necessarily want their employer to know about. People want to do all sorts of things.
That was the point of digital currency in the first place.
They want to pay, cash in hand to get their stepsister out of the washing machine.
Yeah.
digital euros make that hard to do.
All of the surveys report privacy number one absolute got to have. Always they get written up in the central bank reports on this, which I have to read for my job, as saying people are kind of keen on privacy. It's one of their concerns. It's one of the things that they definitely do prioritize, among other things. And then they go, and of course, everyone agrees with us, though, that there should be absolute 100% trackability of this to prevent money laundering. And you read the survey and go, that's not what they were saying at all, guys.
So this is from the consultation paper released by the BOE. It says, at this stage, we judge that it is likely that the digital pound will be needed in the future and that it will offer benefits. Now, again, the benefits that they're allowed to say are quite vague, distant, small. The actual benefit of this will keep Mark Zuckerberg from inventing a new kind of money is still a pretty good one.
Yeah.
So they go on. The digital pound would maintain public access to retail central bank money, thereby anchoring trust in the monetary system. Again, not, I think, a big problem, except among, like, the 10 people who've already moved to Roatan.
Yeah, you are the government. Like, the trust has to repose with you because we've built everything on top of that.
Yeah, 10 people soon to be dead.
New Colonia Dignidad.
Yeah.
So, to finish this, anchoring trust in the monetary system in a more digitalized world and underpinning monetary and financial stability. Also, as lifestyles in the economy become more digital, it would, and here's the killer phrase that makes you know it's going to be crap, through partnership with the private sector, promote innovation, choice, and efficiency in domestic payments, thereby boosting the UK economy, supporting growth, and financial inclusion.
This is the thing, though. We're learning about sort of how sort of like central banks are approaching this, which is, you know, dragging private enterprise in with the one hand and the sort of like big stiletto knife in the other, right? Like, this is firmly a case of capital being able to like subsume opposition to it.
Well, it kind of is and it isn't. And I mean, like, listening to you reading that back, right, you know, now you see why people want OpenAI to be able to write these paragraphs. You know, no one sat down after writing that thinking, this is an exciting day's work. This is what I joined the graduate scheme at the Bank of England to do. The thing is that, I mean, when we were talking about this earlier, you kind of asked the question, you know, how is a central bank currency different from just my debit card that I use in contactless payments? And the answer is, it absolutely isn't. There is no difference at all from the consumer point of view. The Bank of England wants the private sector involvement in this thing, basically because it doesn't want to be offering customer service to all 45 million UK payments customers, you know, in Britain. It's not set up to do that. The thing about payment systems is that they are incredibly technical and boring, you know, and this is not like the normal economic self-deprecating, oh my gosh, this stuff is so boring. You know, this is actually, a friend of mine who worked in the payment systems department of the Bank of England described it as combining the adrenaline rush of telecoms engineering with the erotic charge of double entry bookkeeping. That's, you have to, on the few occasions I've been involved with this, you have to do like spiritual exercises to get your brain capable of handling how insanely boring these protocols are.
It's not all sexy, guys. It's not all shaving poodles, you know.
It's also cool how, if, unless we do all of these sort of things perfectly, unless you sort of, like, do the sort of mentat brain exercises in order to, like, conceive of this stuff, the economy's broken.
That's the thing. Everything has to work, either work perfectly or fail completely every time, because if it half succeeds, then you've got a coin that can be spent twice. And if someone can reproduce that system that lets you spend a coin twice, they can generate a lot of fake money really quickly. So it's just horrible stuff, which is why they want to delegate all of the difficult bit of getting the cards in people's hands and processing the transactions and putting the machines and readers into shops. They want to delegate that to someone else. They just want the whole thing to finally end up so that everything happens on a single server in Threadneedle Street, so that they can have control over it.
We really need to make sure that that server stays in a locked room.
Oh no, be on the Amazon cloud. Why not? Let's have some fun.
I think often about how one of the security systems on ballistic missile submarines is just, there's a stick, like a truncheon, like next to the console. So if anyone tries to get on the console when they shouldn't, you can hit them with the stick. And I think we need to have one of those just like on standby also.
Yeah, we're going to spend all the money from the new Sovereign Wealth Fund on giving everyone who works at the Bank of England a taser.
See, the thing I want to sort of circle back on here as well is the idea of innovation, right? Because the way that that is discussed in the paper is they see this, number one, we've talked, I think, about what it means really, why they actually want to do it, why they ostensibly want to do it, and what it would mean for you, which is almost, crucially, almost nothing. But innovation-wise...
Yeah, so like, do we imagine that the Bank of England has some sort of sinister motives here? No, couldn't possibly.
So,
everything is
so
fine.
So innovation-wise, right, they see it as a kind of platform, a sort of a place where you can, if you are HSBC or whatever, or Starling Bank, you can go through and you can innovate on this ability to, for example, program money.
Yes.
Yeah, programmable money is a very scary thought. And before we describe what that is, I'm going to remind everyone that Britain has a habit, especially in the last 30 years, of creating these systems of fine-grained social control in order to achieve some kind of goal that they see as benign. And those fine-grained systems of social control at some point pass into the hands of even bigger reactionaries who then do all the things that we've seen being done at the Home Office. Again, not that the Home Office really was ever benign, but you get my meaning. Let's talk about programmable money.
Oh, programmable money is not something you will see in the Bank of England document, and you don't see it in ECB documents anymore because they have learned to shut up about it. Because it... But, you know, if you go to industry conferences on this thing, you tend to meet people who get into digital currencies, are really, really keen on the idea of programmable money, and have no idea what they sound like to a normal human being. So you get people saying, well, wouldn't it be great, for example, if you had a kid at university, you could send them some money that they were only able to spend on textbooks and they couldn't spend it on alcohol. Wouldn't that be fantastic? And, you know, you're looking at them going, did you just say that out loud? And, you know, so you could send money that had to be spent within 2 weeks or it just blew up. Or you could give someone some money, but they could only spend 10% of it every month. So they couldn't spend it all at once. Wouldn't that be fantastic? Doesn't that sound like a great innovation?
You could make some money that would only be, you could only use to buy like olive flavored vapes.
Yeah. Well, that's you could, for example, let's say, okay, well, look, there is a parallel financial system. We have Bitcoin, which is distributed, say, directly by the central bank. We also have this other sort of banking system with non-programmable money. However, we've now decided the Department of Work and Pensions is going to be paying out, say, housing benefit in Bitcoin. And by the way, you can't buy like fish with it. You can't buy fresh vegetables with it. You can buy certain tinned foods and you can pay rent. That's sort of about it.
I was going to say, we actually already have this system in London where you get your salary and then 70% of it can only be spent on rent. It's already been implemented.
Yeah. And in fact, they do mention programmable money in the new consultation paper, but again, they don't focus on it. And they say, technology is emerging that allows users to set rules to limit their own spending on certain products, for example, on gambling. And that's what they talk about. They don't talk about the fact that programmable money can be programmed by anyone, so long as they're in control of it.
Yeah, the sort of like the contract law implications.
Yeah, this is why the private sector might come to your rescue, because obviously no high street bank is going to want to be the first one to come out with programmable money, because it's a terrible idea that everyone hates. And they do seem to be stepping away from the surveillance state aspect of this because they want the thing to get widely accepted. One thing I did notice in the Bank of England and the ECB documents is that they are very good at reassuring people that the state and the Bank of England won't have access to all of your transaction data. All of that transaction data is going to stay with the private sector banking system, who are so much more trustworthy.
which the entire sort of apparatus of the security system is already hooked into.
And the security system can get it anytime they want as well. Yeah. Are you feeling reassured? Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, well, hey, guess what, everyone? It will be no worse unless someone really awful gets their hands on it. That has never gone wrong in the past.
If anything, if you're selling this to, like, you know, intelligence services or financial investigators or whatever, this is a benefit because now we're going to have a whole new thing. You don't need to change any of your systems. You're still getting it from the same place. So, you know, perfect. You can still use your same databases. You can still, like, you know, call into the same things.
Well, you also don't need to manage your relationships with, like, your guy at HSBC now who gives you all the things, because now it's just one ledger. Easy. Wait, we've automated more of the guys.
I love to automate a guy.
That's perfect. Coming back around on this, central bank digital currencies have been interesting me largely for a few reasons. Number one, as well, the furthest along trial of a central bank digital currency is, I believe, in Nigeria, the e-Naira, where, again, it has been released to great havoc, as I'm given to understand it. It is relatively unpopular and people don't particularly like using it because people like cash. Like, they mostly prefer cash if they can have it. But secondly, it is
that explains why all my payments from Nigeria are taking so long. That guy promised me I had an inheritance due.
Now, and the other thing as well is that it's a perfect example, I think, of, for reasons other than those that we've discussed, is just looking at an innovation-shaped container and deciding to pour your thing into it. You know, of saying, well, there is this thing that enables us to centralize a lot of power. We must therefore create it, and even though it is, let's say, not responding to demand, I don't mean demand in sort of a democratic sense, but rather in the way that, say, the development of the Industrial Revolution depended on people building machines to keep up with one another's machines, thereby creating, like, economic demand. Something like contactless payments, that was a revolution, that was an evolution in payments infrastructure. It required new rules and new systems. It required new kinds of trust to be implemented so you didn't have to, like, know your secret number, right? That was an innovation. It also responded to a number of, let's say, external forces such as COVID accelerating people not wanting to touch the same payment platform. But until we talked about, though, the fact of needing to force out sort of competing private currencies, this is sort of how I saw central bank digital currencies, as trying to invent something without any real demand for it. But it seems like the demand is coming from inside the house.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as you say, there's the e-Naira, there's the Bahamas Sand Dollar, which also, as far as I can see, hasn't been very popular. People are quite happy with electronic payments and contactless payments. You know, they use them a huge amount. They've got a huge share in Nordic countries at the moment. Cash is basically gone there. But people are happy using them just connected to their bank. Having an electronic version of cash, people are only interested in if it's actually going to be like cash, and for all sorts of reasons. The central banks are never going to give you anything electronic that is actually like cash, in the sense of being able to bundle it up and transfer it with complete offline anonymity. But they kind of feel like they've got to be in this game, as you say, to keep people out of it. And a lot of the time, with central banks in particular, and I think a lot of government organizations are like this, they just build up this sort of power because it might be useful to have it one day. There's no particular reason to be more worried about Mark Zuckerberg inventing the Libra than to be worried about Barclays contactless cards taking market share over physical cash. It's just that someone's looked at it and thought, yeah, we're the Bank of England, we're the Federal Reserve. We don't give away power without someone coming up with a reason to actually stop us from doing something.
It's such a sort of like sign of the times that the like biggest battleground for like state capacity that we're actually contesting is on both sides being contested by people who aren't really that into why they're doing it and sort of like have a mixed understanding of why and what they possibly want to do. It's like perfect ambivalence and sort of like ignorance, and it's just great. I love it, you know?
And I think that the last thing, right, is that, you know, this is power that is being built up and centralized for reasons other than its exercise. And every
time
that happens,
sort of like being accumulated for like to have around, for the same reason that like crypto guys on the sort of libertarian side weren't able to say what they wanted to like break the monopoly of a central bank for, other than just it, you know, vibes, are you triggered? Like, in the same way, you have this like institutional thing where it's like, why do you want to do this? Because we feel like we should be, probably.
Well, you know, and also the libertarian crypto guys were direct descendants of the libertarian gold guys, who you guys will all be too young to remember. But, you know, gold was a huge thing in libertarian world before crypto came along. And it had that same kind of idea of wanting something that was a little bit outside the system. You know, because if you're thinking about real use cases for a central bank, for a CBDC, there's two of them. One is the nice one, where at the start of a pandemic, you might want to, rather than going through all of the measures that we went through, just give everyone £1,000. You know, and you could do that with a touch of a button if everyone had an account that was connected up to the central bank. And that sort of crisis era fiscal policy is something that they have looked at as being a benefit of the central bank digital currency. The other thing that you could do is sanctions policy. You know, you can immediately shut people out of the payments network in a way that you can't immediately shut people out of the cash payments network. So you could, at the start of an international conflict, suddenly get your sanctions list and apply them a lot more rigorously and make it a lot more difficult for sanctioned people to spend their money in London and New York, which is where they want to spend their money. No one actually wants to spend it, you know, in the places where they made it from. And it's that sort of quick, immediate action in unusual, low probability scenarios that the libertarian gold bugs and the libertarian crypto bugs have always been suspicious of central banks. And it's not a wholly unfounded suspicion. It's just kind of a suspicion that tends to be associated with being a bit of a lunatic on lots of other issues.
Bank of England turned my bank account blue and yellow, and now they program my money so I cannot spend it at Maybach dealership. This is bullshit.
Well, like, they all imagine themselves as, like, in the movie Enemy of the State, right? You know, they're falsely accused of something, and, you know, the fucking crooked government comes and shuts down all your bank accounts, locks you out of everything, and now you have to sort of, like, run around downtown Baltimore for a while getting pursued by satellites and shit. Yeah, like some version of that is a sort of plausible bad thing that could happen. But on the other hand, if we like the idea of ISIS not being able to spend money, or like Russian oligarchs not being able to like move their yachts around, then, you know, it's a benefit and a hazard, right? But as I say, it's like contested by people who like don't know what they're contesting or why.
And I think the thing to always remember is that systems of fine-grained social control built by people who don't know what they're contesting or why, those will eventually find their way into the hands of people with plans for them.
I was just sort of thinking about one of the crises that I can definitely sort of foresee, not actually like too far away from here, but the sort of like fixation of like means testing, for example, and how programmable currencies really just sort of fit into that idea of like, you know, just like exacting means testing, but in a much more pointed and in a much more cruel way as well, right? And I can certainly see that being used or being employed, not least by like the probably quite likely like Labour Party kind of coming in and seeing this type of apparatus as being useful for achieving that political goal. even if like the bigger picture type of stuff like doesn't necessarily materialize in the way that maybe some in the Bank of England think it might work. I guess the other question I also had, and I don't know like whether this is sort of too big, but I wondered what your thoughts were on kind of crypto true believers who, some of whom like kind of still think that crypto is, and you know, I'm sure they come from like the libertarian fringe for the most part, but still believe that this is kind of like the source of emancipation. And when they see like central banks like kind of making their own systems, I sort of wondered whether like this has kind of increased their resolve to be like, no, we need to sort of build like, you know, bigger Bitcoin apparatus in order to sort of counter this. Or I guess to put it in like the most delicate terms I can, has the Bank of England made crypto so cringe that they just don't want to do it anymore?
I think that's certainly what they're trying to do. You know, I mean, at the end of the day, the Bitcoin maximalists will now understand that Bitcoin does, I mean, Bitcoin in many ways is a ledger of all the transactions you've ever carried out. So if you are really, if you're doing something really bad that, you know, particularly child pornography, they've got actually very efficient at doing this. If you're doing something that the FBI is prepared to expend real resources on tracking you down, then Bitcoin is a perfect panopticon. You can be immediately associated to that wallet which made that transaction. And there's quite a few people on the non-swing of prisons of Europe, UK and USA who learned that lesson about Bitcoin. But you can't be shut out of the Bitcoin network. You know, you can be shut out of the bank payments network, you know, as you've been talking about with sex workers and some other industries in the past. And you can't be shut out of the physical cash network, but you could be shut out of the central bank cash network. And that kind of underlying fear is definitely what the libertarians are kind of thinking about. And a lot of the purpose, as you say, of bringing in these central bank digital currencies is to just create that fear, uncertainty, and doubt of saying, we're giving you this perfectly efficient, you know, high economies of scale. It will be very well done because the central banks are generally very good at running payment networks. We're giving you this electronic currency. Why would you use anything else unless you've got something to hide? And it's that's the kind of cringe that, you know, they want to definitely create, you know, or not exactly create, but they want to exacerbate the extent to which people regard any other digital currency as being something that's only really used by drug addicts and child pornographers. You know, because of that way, they kind of, I think that probably reduces its brand equity.
So like a concerted campaign to undermine the validity and strength of nonce coin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I was going to say it will surely be the end for libertarianism when it becomes associated with underage child sex of any kind.
So I think on that note, I think of actually like genuine ambivalence about sort of the concept of central bank digital currencies. One of these tools that has so many directions it could possibly be taken, entirely depending upon, of course, who is using it, who is doing the planning.
A bad idea whose time has come.
That's right. Dan, I want to thank you so much for coming and hanging out with us today. Where can people find you online?
I'm not sure I would want people to find me online after that. Now, I'm on Twitter. I've got Lying for Money is in the bookshops. Next book is going to be called Decisions Nobody Made, and it's all about structures and unaccountable power in the corporate world. A lot of the same things we've been talking about. That should be out this summer. In general, it's more a question of how people avoid me than how they find me.
Well, if you want to find Dan on Twitter, we'll include a link to his profile there so you can know to get away from there.
Yeah.
In other news, we will be, actually, the day this comes out is the first official launch of the Trash Future stream after being online for only a couple of years of us forgetting to promote it at every turn.
Yeah.
This is one way in which you can retain privacy. Forget to advertise the product that you try to sell to the general public for 2 years.
Yeah, we wanted to. We don't want it to get too big. We want it to be a niche.
It was a secret menu
it's
product.
Not really commercial,
but now,
you know.
Now it's rolling out.
Yeah. So we're about to do the last. Just after we're finished recording this, we're about to do the last episode of the prologue. Chapter one begins on Thursday.
Yeah, the end of beta testing. Yeah.
And
shows. There are so many.
Well, we have the one in Berlin, but it's sold out now, right?
Yeah, but I have a show in Berlin on the 9th. That's not sold out. Oh boy, is it not? Please come to that. I have never had a show sell so bafflingly slowly in my career. I don't understand. If you live in Berlin and want to prove that the people of Berlin understand how to buy a ticket to a concert, please demonstrate that.
You need to tell them that you have a special guest, and that guest is Lydia Tarr.
That's right. She will be coming on.
Very popular in Berlin, despite the fact that she doesn't exist.
That is right. Yeah. And also, I'm at the Melbourne Comedy Festival in March and April, but immediately prior to that, Perth, Australia, you demanded it. I conceded to your demands and I will be coming to Perth, Australia for a show on the 25th of March. It has cost me a lot of money to do this. Please, again, I beg you, buy tickets to the show.
Perfect. All right. And I think that's the end of our plug section. So once again, Dan, thank you so much. To our listeners, thank you very much for listening. And we'll see you on the free episode in a few days' time. Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.